This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, broadcasting from beautiful New Braunfels, Texas. We are, I guess we can say, the biggest podcast in the world that formerly broadcasted from the west side of Oahu, but is currently broadcasting from the hill country of Texas. I think if I were to, that is a true statement. And we just cracked the top 100 in many countries across the world. And we just, for the first time, we just cracked the top 100 in the Czech Republic. So for everyone listening in the Czech Republic, welcome to the Jason Jones Show. And I always like seeing the different countries where this show is climbing up the ranks. And that means more and more and more people are listening to it. It's still booming across the Hawaiian Islands. It's actually growing since we moved. And that's exciting to see that all my family and friends and neighbors from my home are still tuning in to the podcast. But this is a special episode. It is the first anniversary episode of celebrating the release of my movie, Bella. Bella came out on October 26, 2007. It was the first film I had the privilege to being a part of. And it's the only film of the over 50 films I've worked on that I actually remember the release date. It's the only one. And I think I remember the release date because for two reasons. One, I don't think I've ever worked so hard in my life as we worked on that project. And the fruit from that project, I hear about it all of the time. A month doesn't go by when I don't get an email or a letter from someone sharing with me that they saw the movie Bella and it led to them making the choice for life or some other more interesting and beautiful stories. But who do I interview you? Who do I interview for you today? I have been tongue-tied all day today. I don't know what that is. I could have interviewed Eduardo or the director Alejandro, and I'm going to interview them in the coming weeks. But I chose to interview a Chrissy Stanley. She is one of the thousands of young women who've reached out to us, who saw our film and chose life. And she's one that I got to develop a relationship with, her and her daughters, Bella and Millie. And she actually today works for Movie to Movement, and she's part of our team marketing Divided Hearts of America. And the reason I want to interview her is because she is who I was thinking about and why the whole time we were working on Bella. And it's why, in a way, it was such a challenging project. Because at every step of the way, especially because we were novices, one mistake or leaving anything off the field, not putting it all in the field, one mistake or any kind of slacking would have led to the film not being distributed, not being a success. And I knew that if our film was a success, that it would have a dramatic impact in that countless young women would choose life. And so it was kind of, I was thinking about Chrissy before I knew Chrissy. Our whole team was. And so to me, what is the fruit of Bella? Tripling its production budget and ticket sales. Yay. Winning so many film festivals, including Toronto. Hooray. But really, what is the joy of our film are the stories of moms like Chrissy and her two twin daughters, Bella and Millie. So let's just get on with the interview. This episode is being brought to you by Movie to Movement. Go to our website, movietomovement.com, where you will find the links to where you can stream our film. And you can watch it. You get 20% off with the code MTM. So go to movietomovement.com. Check out our new movie, Divided Hearts of America, where we reveal the secret that will unite our country. That's right. And it's about to be the most divisive week in American history. Pray God it's not, but I'm anticipating that. So find out the secret that will unite us at movietomovement.com. Put in our code MTH for that 20% off. All right. Interviewing Chrissy Stanley, Bella mom, Movie to Movement teammate, and mother of Bella and Millie, the Jason Jones Show. Aloha, Chrissy Stanley. Welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Hello.
Do you know why you're on my show today?
I have a pretty good idea.
Why are you on my show? I called you today. I'm like, hey, do you want to do a show today? It just dawned on me. Why are you on my show today?
Well, a few years back, I think 13, 14 to be around that time frame, I'm assuming you came out with a fabulous movie and it impacted me, strongly impacted me. I know we're celebrating an anniversary and I'm loving it, every bit of it.
It is. It is our, in a way, it is our anniversary. Me, you, Millie, Bella, Eduardo, Sean, Leo, Alejandro, Tammy, all of us. We didn't know you, but we were knit together 13 years ago today. So So before we begin on that, though, I want to get on that. It is the anniversary of my first narrative feature film, Bella. My first film was a documentary, The Gates of Hell. But this is my first feature film. And today's the anniversary. And I want to tell you some of the stories and share with the audience that I think you might find interesting. But before we get to that, I want to interview you. How do I broadcast and speak for a living? I would like to interview you regularly for a reason. You and I have similar paths in life. You're just earlier on the journey. I say that you are in the beginning of Act Two. And I want to do regular updates with you. We've done one show already. So you are in true Act Two form on your lunch break at work.
Yes, right now.
That's awesome. I'm like, can you do an interview today? You're like, yeah, but I got to do it around my lunch break. How long is your lunch break?
It's an hour.
Are you going to be able to eat on the job, seeing that I'm taking your time to eat away from you?
Yeah, I do typically do that in between phone calls. I'm munching on snacks and stuff, but I'm on keto right now. So it's easier for me to do snacks than it is for like full meals.
I start keto tomorrow.
Stop. Are you serious?
Every day I say I'm going to start keto tomorrow, but I never do. Oh, but tomorrow I'm going to start keto. Or I was like keto yesterday. Sometimes I'm keto for like three whole. I never am keto long enough to go into ketogenesis. Isn't that what it's called?
Yeah, ketosis. Same thing. Ketosis. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm never on a keto diet long enough to go into ketosis.
If you eat meat, if you're like, I'm a carnivore, so you could totally be carnivore keto, which is awesome. But I legitimately could eat any kind of meat, and that's the thing. But anyway.
I did keto once.
I have lost 20 pounds.
No, it's first of all, if you lost 20 pounds, I'm nervous because I don't think you should ever lose 20 pounds from the last time I saw you unless you really COVIDed it up. Did you gain a lot of weight during the shutdown?
I grew up. So normally you see me and I'm about 120 pounds. Well, from February to August, I was like 160-something. So I just had to get back to my normal weight. I felt super uncomfortable.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you're feeling, and I do love keto. I have done keto successfully a few times and I feel great. So here's what I wanted to share with you, Chrissy, on the air. First, maybe why don't you tell everyone who doesn't know sort of how Bella impacted you, and then I want to share with you a little bit about what was happening 13 years ago today.
So when I was in college, I was faced with an unplanned pregnancy. At the time, my boyfriend decided that it would be in our best interest to not go through with having a child. We fought about it. We talked about it, fought about it, talked about it, and fought more. And then one day I decided, you know, they have all of these signs and all of these things when you start to search for where to have an abortion or how, because you don't know those things. That's not something that's just kind of presented to you. So I ended up finding a pregnancy service center that was amazing where we were at. Mind you, we were away to college. And so I'm not from the town that I'm in. And so I found a place that kind of pulled me in off their website, and it asked, you know, are you faced with an unplanned pregnancy? So it was, yeah, that's me. And then it said, you know, make an educated decision or choice on what to do with your circumstances. And that felt more comfortable than pricing of abortions listed online. So my goal was to go to this place and get information and make an educated decision on what I wanted to do, but also to try to appease my boyfriend at the time by letting him hate to say it out loud, but honestly, it was more of letting him think he had control of the situation. But to be honest, I was still scared in the beginning as well.
What's interesting about your experience, which is so many experiences, we're told it's a choice between a woman and her doctor, and so oftentimes the doctor's a man. But in my experience with my friends and family and other people who've gone through a crisis pregnancy, it seems so often the man is the one who is either trying to take control of the situation or actually has control of the situation.
It is, and it's funny that you say that, because when you say a man, it's not always the boyfriend. In a lot of instances, in fact, in yours, it was the father of the, you know what I'm saying? So some people look at it like it's always the boyfriend or the husband, or it's always the man in that sort, but the man comes in many different forms. And then also the woman thinking that, you know, this is her body. Don't get me started on that, but it's not just a topic that's about a woman's body and her rights. It's so much more than that. But yeah, I was in that position, and he decided it wasn't the best time. And so we went to this pregnancy service center, and they were, you know, counseling and praying and offering a lot of help if we decided to choose life. And they said, well, here, just take this DVD that we have. They were donated to us. I think it'd be really awesome. It'd be a great thing if you just watch this and get back to us. Let's schedule another appointment, not even to talk about your situation, but to talk about the movie. And I was kind of like, all right, sure. You know, I didn't think too much of it. So ended up getting the movie, and lots happened after that.
So when they gave you the movie, so Movie to Movement donated about, you know, tens of thousands of DVDs to pregnancy centers over the years. Unfortunately, DVDs aren't as attractive as they were in 2008, 9, 10. Mm-hmm. But we would have them usually give them in little bags with like candy and popcorn. Did they give it to you like in a little bag, or did they just hand you the DVD?
Honestly, I don't think there were any frills. I think if they just handed me the DVD with some paperwork.
Okay. So tell me about when you first watched Bella.
So the first time, and I admit this a lot, it's really kind of sad, but when I went to go watch it, at first I was just kind of like, I'm not really, this isn't my style, you know? So I was cleaning the house. I didn't want to watch it with him because I knew it was going to be, you know, something that was going to be a tearjerker for me. So he went to school and I was feeling sick. So I stayed home and I was kind of cleaning around the house, and I kind of let it play in the background. Well, after it got done, I wasn't done cleaning, so I let it play again. So I just turned it right back on because we didn't have cable. I was a broke college student. So let it play again, and I just kept getting pulled into the movie at certain parts. The first part was when Tammy was in the bathroom and she found out that she was pregnant. And then I kind of paused there. I felt what she felt, kept doing what I was doing. And I always say I literally got pulled into the movie at the point in time that reminded me of being at home. It was when the family was surrounding the dining table and they were going person by person and kind of talking, and they were kind of telling the rest of the story, and they started to pray before the food. And I literally bowed my head with them and started, like I was there,
oh,
like I was
so
in the
beautiful
room with them.
Mm-hmm. Do you know that scene was written on set? That was not originally in the film. Originally, when Eduardo was on the train, he was just going to give a bunch of answers to her questions. But at the last minute, the writer-director, who I think is one of the greatest directors of our time, Alejandro Monteverdi, said, you know what, let's just let her talk and let's give her the perfect answer. All of her doubts and questions revolved around her sorrowful, empty childhood. Let's show her how beautiful a family can be. And it was that scene that also very much resonated with the Latino community. They were so happy for the first time in Hollywood history, really, the first time in Hollywood history where a Latino family was portrayed as beautiful and happy and successful and strong.
Absolutely.
Which is, it's bizarre. But so that scene really impacted you.
Absolutely, 100%. And I would have never thought that it wasn't something that was just, because it was such a touching moment for me. Like I said, it did. It reminded me of home. It reminded me of family. It reminded me of love. And how could you put yourself in a position where if you value family so much, you know, to take away or even consider taking away the life of one of the most precious gifts ever to be received by God. So that it hit me early and it hit hard. And I wanted him to watch it with me as well. That scene, I can't even imagine that scene wasn't planned. That scene was amazing.
Well, you know, what's interesting is my childhood was a bit like Nina's. But I always wanted to have, I always had a vision of what my life would be like as a father. And I mm-hmm. live it, you know, I do. I live what I envisioned as a boy by the grace of God. And, so that scene, where is I going with that? So, but your family was like that.
Yeah.
So it reminded you Absolutely. Of your family. Now, was your boyfriend, did he come from a good family as well? So what scenes impacted him? Do you remember?
Honestly, no. He kind of watched it with me. I think just the end, just the, you know, the culmination of everything that was happening throughout the film and then the true meaning of the film.
When Jose you know? Whispers in her ear, I'll adopt your baby.
Yep. So, but I think the way that he was raised is very different as well. I wouldn't say it's similar to Nina's upcoming or yours in any way. His parents were together. They were awesome, but their connectiveness, their feeling, their family feel wasn't necessarily there. They didn't do hugs and kisses. They didn't, you know what I'm saying? So that kind of stuff. And so it was a little bit cold sometimes trying to understand his background and trying to put together what I was used to and show him the family feel. It was easier for him to say, let's just do this when we're ready, or let's not do this now because it's not the time. And I think for me, it's like, if God wouldn't give it to you if he couldn't see you through it. You know what I'm saying? So I think that was a big thing for me.
So now you saw the film. When you saw Bella, because there's more to the story I want to get to, where did it mm-hmm. after watching it, were you confirmed, like, I'm going to keep the baby? You didn't know there were babies yet. Or were you still wrestling with it, or what was going on after you watched the film?
You're right. I did not. So in my mind, and this is taking it back prior to this, so I actually had a previous abortion prior to this. And I was actually told by doctors that if for any reason I did get pregnant, that either myself or my child would die during childbirth. So even after Bella, I still was wrestling with it, because the first thing that I thought of was me and my life. And if it could be ended because of this. And I think just the fact that you don't know what you don't know, you know, and trying to progress forward, you can't plan those kind of things out. And I was just like, you know, I had ended up getting to a point where it was, I'm going to try it or I'm going to die trying. So either myself or my child, it won't be the first time that this would have happened, and it won't be the last, but I can at least assure myself that I'm going to try fully. So it did confirm with me, but in the back of my mind, I still wanted to please my boyfriend. I still wanted him to be happy. And so I guess I kind of played along with it. Well, let's check and see if it's a viable pregnancy. Let's, you know, look into it further and make sure everything is okay and that I will be okay. But I think it did. It was a strong confirmation from the movie Bella that there's no way.
But there was but he said something sort of bizarre, right? And that led to mm-hmm. making it easy. So share us about what he said out of the blue for no reason.
Yeah. So the funny thing is he hadn't said anything positive at all to acknowledge the pregnancy throughout the entire first few weeks. Actually the entire, it was 11 weeks. Cause I found out at 11 weeks, nine, I'm sorry. Anyway, so for the first 9 weeks, he hadn't said anything positive about the pregnancy. And so the night before the ultrasound, he rolls over in bed and puts his hands on my stomach. And this is after me, you know, trying to convince him, talk to him, whatever. He puts his hands on my stomach and he goes, you know what? If it's twins, we got to keep it, because that's just too cool. Nobody has twins. And I was kind of annoyed that it had to be two in order for, you know, for him to change his mind. Not because it was a life, but because it was twins. So I just kind of rolled over and went to sleep. The next day we're on our way to the pregnancy service center to get the ultrasound. And it was an argument back and forth. And once we finally got there, I said, okay, this is the door. Stop arguing. I'm not doing this in front of people. I literally put my hands on the doors and looked up at the sky just to be, and they say now they call it petty. So petty Betty. So I put my hands on the door and looked up in the sky, and I just said, God, whatever is inside my stomach, please multiply it right now. Because I knew what he said.
And then you go in, you get the ultrasound.
Slung the doors open, go in, get the ultrasound, and the lady's like, I don't think you're ready for this. And so I immediately start crying because I thought, you know, exactly what the doctors had said prior, that the baby passed or something was wrong. And she goes, I don't think you're ready for this. There's twins in there. And I just started bawling, and I looked at him, and he put his head down and shook his head and literally murmured, my big fat mouth.
God is good. So, okay, so that's amazing. And then you keep, okay, so now you're keeping the baby. He's committed at this time to being a father. So he's committed. At this point, he's like, okay, we're going to do this. He's in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't hear about you until, I do hear about you, I think, right when you made the decision to life and you told the center, I think they called me. But I was on the set, I was in Universal Studios, City Lot, Back Lot, no, Soundstage, where we had built this German, like this, you know, this old German town in a soundstage. Mm-hmm. We were on the very important scene for the movie Crescendo, where Beethoven is being born. So it's the birth scene of Beethoven. And I'm watching this labor go on and on. And it's such a powerful scene that the entire cast of Desperate Housewives is there, and they're watching. Also, Allie Landry's there because she plays Beethoven's piano teacher, and so we have all these folks there. Eduardo Verasky, of course, is there. Then somebody from your pregnancy center—I forget who it was. Do you remember who called me?
It was Lindy.
Yeah. Okay, Lindy. So Lindy calls me. And she says, remember the girl I told you about? I'm going to cry just saying it. Like, she sounded desperate. She said she might not make it. And I'm like, what? She's like, she needs you to pray for her. And then I do not know what even gave me the courage to say this or why I even said this. I said, can you bring the phone to her and can we pray with her? And then the entire cast, we broke the set. Father Willie was there, I believe. But we all prayed for you. All of us. And I remember looking around, and I gave the phone to Eduardo, and I'm looking around at the entire cast and crew dressed up like they're in the streets of, you know, 1760 in Bonn, Germany. And they're all there in hair and makeup, everything, just praying for you, these big stars praying for you. And then tell us what was going on, and then you don't remember talking to me. Tell the truth. You don't. You remember talking to Eduardo.
So I didn't know.
Okay, so tell us. So tell us what was going on, and then what happened when everyone started praying. Because there are these stories I remember. And I'm like, am I exaggerating to myself? What happened? Did this really happen this way? So tell us what happened.
No. So I had a bunch of fluid on my lungs. I had been in active labor at that point for about 24 hours. So it was, and I remember dates because, of course, it was a couple of days before the girls were born. So. It was August 6, 2010, and I get a phone call to the hospital room, and I answer it, and Lindy was on the line, and she says, hey, I want you to talk to someone, and now, mind you, I'm in pain, my liver's failing.
Okay, I'll excuse you for not remembering me, but none of that stopped you from remembering Eduardo, but anyways, keep going.
So there was a lot of things going down. The heart rate was going down for the babies. I was full of medicines that they had given me to slow down the contractions, which slowed down my heart rate as well. And then I went paralyzed from the neck down a few days prior. Just everything that you could think in a high-risk pregnancy, everything that you could think of was happening. And so she gets on the phone, and she's like, Jason Jones. And I'm like, who? And she goes, Bella, you know. And okay, yeah. So now I'm like, hello? And you guys start praying for me. And while you're praying for me, we're looking over at the monitor. It's beeping less. And it's slowly coming back. Everything, the heart rate, my heart rate. Millie's heart rate, the baby's heart, it's just, everything just went back to normal during that prayer. And it was a powerful moment. It was, everything went right back to normal. They stayed in there for another day or so, but we didn't have any complications at birth. But leading up to it, it was turmoil. It was everything that you would think a high-risk pregnancy is what it was. But it was like at that moment, God literally placed his hands on my belly, my heart, my head, and told me, have faith in me. We got this. I got this for you.
Well, and that's unbelievable to me. And it's one of those things, like, you know, God, I say, I don't believe in God. I know in God. Like, he winks at us all the time. To me, that's just unbelievable. And the power of prayer and knitting us together in a community. And you've been a part of, in a way, to me, all of my movies, like, since Bella, you know, in a way you were a part of Bella. You helped me market films, like, because of Gracia and others. And now you're in my new movie, Divided Hearts of America. We talked when I was on the set of Crescendo, and being able to watch Bella and Millie grow up and get to know them. And we've hung out, right? All over the country. We've hung
all
out.
Over.
Like, museums in Chicago. We hung out at the Ritz-Carlton. I think it was the Ritz, some nice hotel that had a great arcade. And
paddle boats.
And paddle boats. And, you know, for me, let me tell you, when we made Bella, it was such a hard movie to make. It took Eduardo almost going homeless to make that movie because he turned away from his career. And I always tell Eduardo, brother, whenever I hear a Bella story, and we hear so many stories, I don't get to know so many of them as well as I know you, so many stories, you know. Let me share with you two that are amazing to me. One is a guy was telling me he saw Bella, and he said, can I tell you, you know, my wife and I were going to get an abortion, and he, as he's telling me the story, he just says, yeah, my wife got pregnant by another guy, and she confessed it to me, and we went to a pregnancy center and they gave us Bella. And after the movie, we watched the movie, I just turned to her and said, I want to be your Jose. I'm going to cry. He's like, I want to be your Jose.
Oh my, what's that called?
I want to be your Jose.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, no, there's so many. Another story is I was in DC giving a speech at the Students for Life event to like 5,000 kids. And they're like, this girl needs to talk to you. She just took the bus to the train to a bus to come see you. And she's got to leave to go back to Philadelphia. And I was like, what? This is very weird. Like, I don't know where this is going. And it was a 16-year-old girl, like full-term pregnant. She said, I was scheduled to get an abortion. We watched Bella in Spanish class. I Googled you guys. I decided to keep my baby. I Googled around and I found out who you are and what you do. And I saw you were going to be close to me. Close. She lived in Philly. She came to DC. She's like, I got to be home tonight. I just came here to... Do you want to see, you know, touch your next Bella baby? And she put my hand on her tummy. And then another Bella story that was just amazing. My good friend, Patrick, I got to have him on because this is another one of those stories I tell people and they're like, you're lying. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm lying when I tell your Crescendo story. I'm like, that's just not true. And then here's another one. I'm like, this isn't true. I was going to Houston. Or I forget where. Dallas, maybe. Or maybe Dallas and Houston with Eduardo to raise money for Little Boy. And I used to never cut my hair unless I had to meet with somebody important or give a speech or something. So you might, if I didn't have an event in for 4 or 5 months, I look like a hippie, just wild and out of control hair. So all of a sudden at the last minute, we get invited. No, it wasn't the last minute. I put it off to the last minute to get my hair cut. And it must've been some holiday or something. I don't remember. But we were going to Texas and to meet with some Texas investor type guys, and I looked like a wild hippie. I'm like, I got to get my hair cut. And I looked all around for a place that was open, and there was no place open that I could go. And I lived near the Americana in L.A., in Glendale, and there was this Art of Shaving place. Am I boring you? This is going somewhere, I promise you, Chrissy.
No.
This is going somewhere. So I go to the Art of Shaving, and it's like, $80 for a haircut. And I remember thinking, oh, this is not good. I better take cash out so my wife doesn't know I just spent $80 on a haircut. I can't use the bank card. So I take, I'm like, but I got, it's worth it. I'm asking people for hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. I can pay for an $80 haircut if I have to. So I go in and it comes with a shave. So I'm like, okay, I draw the cash out so my wife won't see, right? So I pay for the $80 haircut. Well, so I go in and as the guy is cutting my hair, you know, or I'm sorry, giving me a shave. He's got me back. I never had it done before. He's got this big blade out. He's like, you know, scraping my neck. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, what do you do? And I say, oh, I work for Metanoia Films. We make movies. And like, what movies? I'm like, have you ever seen the movie Bella? And this was just a couple of years after Bella came out. And he stopped everything. Put the have I ever told you the story?
No.
He folded the razor blade up, set it down, walked in front of me, crossed his arms, and just stared at me. And I couldn't read what the staring was going on. It was, he was looking at me like I was staring at a mystery or something.
Yeah.
And he said, Bella, I saw that movie. I said, you saw that movie? Oh, here's something I need to tell you. I had arranged for when Eduardo and I were going to Texas, I was setting him up for Eduardo to do everything that Pepper Busby did in Little Boy. So the seven works of mercy, I was setting it up for Eduardo to do all seven of those as we traveled the country. So while we were going to Texas, we were going to visit those in prison, in the general population, and in visit those in death row. I had arranged it. So he sets, so that, just remember that. So he stares at us, stares at me, and he goes, I need to tell you something. Your movie changed my life. He said, I've been in prison, in and out of prison my whole life. I had five kids. Not a good father to any of them. I found Jesus between committing my last crime and sentencing. So I spent my last 5 years in prison as a missionary. I got out of prison. I'm going to this good church. And this is, he's just telling me the story. I'm going to this church. And there's this beautiful woman. She's an actress. She's a dancer. She works for Tyler Perry. This, that. She's so beautiful. She's so young. She's got a PhD. She's so everything. That, you know, we became really good friends. But I never even thought to date her because she was such a good woman. I was such a bad man. Well, one day the phone rings and she calls me. And she says, hey, I want to go on a date. He goes, I hung up the phone and threw it. And I was so scared, I didn't know what to do.
What?
He said the phone.
Why?
Because he wasn't good enough for her. So he goes, the phone rings again. And he says, she says, hey, I want you to take me on a date, like boyfriend, girlfriend. So I don't know what to take her. I don't know what to do. I'm like, I'm going to take her on a date. I'm going to be real cold, this, that, and I'm going to let her move along with her life. So I'm listening to a KKLA, Christian radio station, and this guy comes on. I'm like, oh, yeah, that was me. I did the KKLA interview promoting the movie. He goes, well, I heard you. And you were talking about Bella. I said, well, if Christian radio is talking about it, it must be good. So I bought a ticket to Bella. And as we're sitting there watching Bella, and I realize, and I see what Jose did. He, you know, he killed a girl. He was reckless, and he killed a child. He went to prison. Then at the end of the movie, when I saw what he did, how he redeemed himself, how he was a good man, he was worthy of that child. He became a good man. I heard God tell me, and you're a good man now, and you are worthy of this woman.
Oh.
He's like, now we're married. She looks like Halle Berry. We got, takes out his phone. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, no way she looks like Halle Berry. She looks like Halle Berry, okay? She does. And I said, okay, now that's your story. Can I tell you a story? I said, yeah. I go, I'm going to Texas tomorrow. I needed a haircut because I'm meeting with some potential investors. I do not want to spend $80 for a haircut, but you're all that I could find. I had to take cash out so my wife didn't know. I'm speaking to a prison the day after tomorrow, and I have nothing to tell them. I did not know what I was going to say, and I met you, and I'm going to tell them about you and how you didn't believe in yourself, but God believed in you and how you came from this, and now look where you are charging people like me $80 for a haircut. I said, you made it, brother. And and I watch him and his wife and their family grow. And I'm like, that was Bella too, in a way. So
yeah,
crazy, right?
That's awesome. That's one of those stories too that I would have never thought come from a film like that, but that's amazing.
I've got a bunch of ex-con stories. There's one so personal with someone so famous, like I can't say. I wish I could say. I'll say this. The former lady, I can't say it. Former first lady, George Bush's wife, George W.'s wife. What's wrong with my brain? What is wrong with my brain? I probably shouldn't say it. That's God's way of saying don't say it. Anyway, yeah, I always hear these strange stories from people who loved Bella that you would never know why they loved Bella. And then they tell you, and you're like, we never thought of that. We thought of women choosing life, right? Mm-hmm. We never, ever thought of, we meet so many people that were involved in car accidents that saw Bella and it allowed them to feel forgiveness for themselves. Because Jose, because Jose, you don't even remember the car accident, do you?
Oh, I do. That kills me every time.
Right? But it's, in a way, it's not something I would have thought
but
of.
But it's not the main, it's not the main part of the movie. So it depends on what stage of life you're in when you're watching it. There are multiple, now that you're, explaining it to me more, there's multiple parts of the movie that
people who are in prison, people crisis pregnancies, people who lost careers that were important to them. Of course, and I want to apologize. Laura Bush, if you're listening to my podcast, don't unsubscribe because I forget my kids' names. You ever forget your kids' names? You're just like,
I just
you,
make them together.
Come here. Well, you have twins. Yeah. It's harder, right?
Yeah, I just mix them together. Millie and Bill, it turns out to be Billy sometimes. So
you just call them, what do you call them? Billy?
Sometimes I'll just yell Billy. And they both come running.
When I'm with them for a day, I know by the end of the day the difference. So as I'm figuring it out, I'm just going to call them Billy next time we're hanging out.
No answer.
Well, why I wanted to share your story is, making a movie is hard. Making the types of movies we make, and you're helping right now, you're on staff, you're working with us on Divided Hearts of America. You're finding out how challenging it is, right, to market a film, to promote a film, to finance a film's production, then to produce a film, and then to get into the festival circuit or to get distribution. And I remember at the time when Bella came out, 13 years ago today, I had a toddler. Maximilian was a toddler. Mm-hmm. And I was at the world premiere. I sat my father-in-law in between LL Cool J and who was it? I set him next to LL Cool J and Tony Bennett. So I put him in between Tony Bennett and LL Cool J at the premiere.
Oh, wow.
And in New York. And I was so happy. And we were at the Peninsula Hotel and I was organizing marketing all over. Goya Foods purchased $500,000 in tickets. And I was working with radio stations, Christian stations, Latino stations, public schools in Westchester County, busing kids to and from. So I was running this huge operation, and then my wife calls me. Max reached up and grabbed my sister's cup of tea and got third-degree burns from his shoulders down to his hand. My boss, the gentleman who financed Bella, financed the P&A, I was working for him at the time, and he said, you need to come back now. He ordered me back home to visit my wife and kids in the hospital. And I said, no. He goes, I'm telling you, you're there because you work for me. I'm like, I quit. I'm running my operation. I quit. You can't tell me. My son is fine. He's in pain. My wife's dealing with it. I'm running the marketing of this campaign. And countless lives depend on the success of the marketing of this campaign. My wife has got this. I am not coming home. Even my biggest mentors that day calling me, lecturing me. You need to think about your family. But in my mind, I knew. I was telling my team, for each ticket we sell, a DVD we sell. The bigger the theatrical release, the bigger the DVD release. I said, the more famous we make Eduardo, the broader his reach. It was a fight week in and week out for months. And we took Bella to being one of only three films that year that tripled its production budget and ticket sales. And then, of course, with DVD, it set all kinds of records. But what was most exciting to me was not the theatrical release, but was DVD. I said, we have to have a big theatrical release So we have a big DVD splash, and we were in Targets and Walmarts. But my goal from the beginning was to hand Bella out at pregnancy centers. And wow. There were years of work that went in to being able to donate a Bella DVD to your pregnancy center to hand to you. Mm-hmm. Years. Millions of dollars that investors had to invest. And then there were, Eduardo had to sacrifice his career, went from being wealthy and famous to walking away from Hollywood, throwing everything into Bella. When financing mm-hmm. came in for Bella, Chrissy, you won't believe this, Eduardo was 1 month away from being homeless. Mm. And I tell Eduardo, it was that sacrifice, that trust, that every Bella story was grounded in your willingness to be homeless.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it was that courage of Eduardo's that knit our friendship together. But how much time do you have? Because I want to talk a little bit about Act Two.
I got about 15 minutes.
Do you want to talk about Act Two?
Yeah, we can.
So my goal with this podcast, I don't know if you listen. It's awesome. By the way, we are in the top 100 this week, and we are in the top 100. We added a country, the Czech Republic, top 100. Aloha to the Czech Republic. You think I'm kidding you? No, we're cracking it. We're in the top 20 in New Zealand, Australia, the UK.
I love that we can get those statistics. It just cracks me up that you could say, you know, we're in the top 20 in the Czech Republic. Like, I would never think that.
I wouldn't either. I'm like, well, that's interesting. I can tell you how many people are listening to my podcast at a given moment in Kapolei, Hawaii. Kapolei, you've been listening to my podcast. Hundreds and hundreds of you. And I know that's because you miss me. That they miss me.
That home time, love, and support.
That's the girl at the bank counter. I know who it is. It's the grocery store people. Because they tell me. They listen. And they're like, I'll miss that crazy guy. Well, but the whole goal with this podcast is to talk to my friends and talk about subjects the way I would talk alone in my garage on a stool drinking a beer. Like, just to be honest.
Yeah.
And no, if I wanted not to be honest, I could do a radio show on a big network. But the idea with the podcast is just say it like it is. So one of the things that I think is so important for me and our friendship is you remind me of how hard the struggle is. And we know that when we choose life, you know, it's so exciting. And we could end the story with, you had Bella and Millie and life's been a bed of roses ever since. But for all of us who know, especially those of us who are young parents and teen parents, like I was, it's not easy, right? And so your boyfriend, Bella and Millie's father, he bounced pretty quick, right? So he was in for a bit, but then how long after the girls were born before he disappeared from their life?
Oh, he was there for about 7 months. He was there. It was literally 7 months, and then it was no more. So it wasn't. They lived happily ever after, that's for sure.
No, right? And what's sad is I came and I met him, and he shared with me that he was torn between the world and manning up.
Yeah.
He told me, he was like, I was struck by his honesty. He said, you know, I'm attracted to these things that aren't good, and I'm torn between these two worlds. And he said, but I'm going to man up. But it was like not much longer than he bounced.
Yep.
And so now you being a single mom, and the girls were born on August 9th. I'll never forget that. But I forget the year though. What's the year?
8, 9, 10. Just count.
What do you mean?
Yeah. Cincinnati almost did an article on them, actually. So after I got off the phone with you, they almost did an article. They were the twins of 8, 9, 10. But they're
8, 9, 10. I got you.
Yep. August 9th, 2010.
Oh, I should know. Yeah.
But there was also.
Yeah, we were on the set of Crescendo. So 8, 9, 10. So they're 10 years old. And you work hard. You've, and you struggle. So the act two is not easy, is it?
No, absolutely not. You can't ever foresee, you can't ever assume what could happen, but you also have to make the best of it. And so I don't regret anything about my situation, about my journey. 100%, I'm all for it, even during the tough times, even during the hard time.
You know, something about social media is it's like a thermometer on all your friends. Like if you're an empathetic person, sometimes it can be overwhelming because you can kind of read your friends through their social media, right? And yeah. This week I've been reading you, you know, this week you're mad that there's not, dad's not in the life. Like I've noticed it, you know, you go years without posting anything. And I saw a few posts. Can you talk to me about that? Or talk to us about that. Like, what is that? Sometimes.
Actually, I'm glad you asked.
Okay.
No, seriously though, with everything that's coming across, working on, you know, where I want to be and where I want to get to, obviously it is really difficult, but within 2020, even though it's been actually the worst year for almost everybody, it's actually in my pro-life journey been probably one of the most successful, from podcasts to interviews to newsletters to the film release, to speeches, virtual speeches, and opportunities in my pro-life life. So it's been the most beneficial there. But I'll tell you what, the people that called me and asked me to do a virtual speech for them, the day of the virtual speech, she calls me first thing in the morning. It's supposed to air at noon. It's 8 a.m. in July. This is right after my birthday. And I'm on a high because I'm feeling good. I just done your podcast, and because I think we did the podcast on my birthday. But so everything's coming into place, and she gives me a call at 8:30 in the morning and says, "Hey, Chrissy, I just felt it on my heart to look up the girl's dad because I know he stayed in this area after you moved." And I said, "And I haven't told you about this thing." So she said, "I looked him up. I Googled him. I Googled his name." She says, "Have you ever done that?" And I said, "No, why would I?" He walked away. Why would I? She says, "Well, I looked him up and I don't think you're going to like what I've seen." And so now I'm thinking, like, you could do what you want in your personal life, but if it's really going to affect what I've got going on in my life, then it's a problem. She looked him up. He had been in and out of jail, attempted murder, conspiracy to... I don't know all of the terms, conspiracy to murder or rob or attempted burglary, drug-related stuff, just crazy stuff. So now I'm thinking, everything that I've got going for me, everything that my true passion, living and walking my journey and my passion, everything is going to come to a fall. Another thing that this man could ruin for me. These are my thoughts. So I tell myself, okay, I'm going to get back into writing this book. I'm going to make sure my book is on Act 2. Make sure I work on it. So I've committed to picking days on the calendar, writing it. And I get to the point where I have to talk about him. And so psychologically, I know it's going to affect me. I know it's going to bring up those thoughts and those feelings and those emotions. And a lot of it is that. And I've always been an open book. I've always been the kind of person that, yeah, I'm a Christian, but yeah, I drink, you know, that's me. I'm honest. I'm straightforward. And I have a lot of,
you sound like a Catholic Christian right there. Okay. Okay. Go on.
But yeah, I'm just a realist in my walk in life as well. So I believe in God, but I also believe in a lot of the things that are happening nowadays. And so I'm pretty straightforward with it. You can read a lot of that on my post. So it's crazy that you asked that because, yeah, I've been reliving a lot of those horrible times because I'm in that point in my book and I've avoided it.
Let me give you some film school. Like I'm going to give you a little film school right here. So, and the hero's journey, you know, you're in Act 2. Your call to adventure was Bella and Millie, but really the heart of Act 2 is going into the depths, the darkness of the innermost cave where you come face to face with your greatest fear.
Uh-huh.
And this is the man who, by the way, I met him and I liked him a lot. Like I really liked him. And hearing this is shocking because he seemed like, obviously the world's attractive and he was attracted to the things of the world that are alluring, right? But he seemed like just a really good guy that couldn't find the will to do what he knew to be right. And so,
yeah, because his heart was gold.
You could see that.
He wanted it to be. And it did. It was something that you got from him. It was a vibe that you got from him. But it was just the decision-making process on a lot of things. It was just, it would leave you stunned.
And one bad decision leads to the next bad decision, where like being in the life of his girls would have been one great decision that could have would have led to many, many, many other great decisions, and which would have led to a beautiful life. And so you know, that's the heart of your book, I think, because those two beautiful girls are part you and part him. Mm-hmm. And that's the great fear. That's the great struggle. Like, you want them to be all yours because you're raising them all by yourself.
Yeah.
And you want their heart to be all yours, their mind, their imagination to be all yours. But no, their mind and their imagination drifts and dreams of him.
Mm-hmm.
And they long for him, and they are him. You know, they are him. I remember, I don't know why, I don't know if you've ever had this fear, but with my children, I always had this fear that I would die young, especially my first two children, because I was in the infantry, right? Mm-hmm. And I had them very young. I had this fear, like, if I die young, they'll never know who I am. And and I want them to know me. I want my children to know me. And I just kind of had this feeling then that I'd die young. But then one day it dawned on me, my children don't need to remember me. They are me.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Your children are us. They're us. And your girls are you, but they're also him. In a way, he chose to die on them. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change the fact that they're him. And so that's your fear, that they are him and that they, you know, so I think that's, and I don't, because I'm not a woman, right? So I don't know how to articulate that. I don't know the nuances and the subtleties of all those thoughts and feelings. But the only reason to write a book is to help other people, right?
Yeah.
And so how many young women are, they're going to, countless young women are approaching the same place of that cave that you're approaching now. And countless young women for the rest of the human history will approach that innermost cave that's similar to yours. So I think you might have just now struck on the heart of your book. So, but why this week? So that was in July, but this week I noticed a bunch of posts on, you did one, every child deserves a father, something like that, I remember. What was that?
So, a lot of it is because I'm getting into, digging into that chapter. I'm digging into that being a single mom, you know, and the experiences. And so, my dad is getting sick as well, the older I get. I recently went through a breakup with an amazing man. So fingers crossed, we'll just keep that in everybody's prayer pocket. But
yeah, I loved him, by the way.
I love him.
I really love him. Yeah, I love him.
We're just gonna keep that.
Your generation, like, you know, these are what you're going through. So many young women and men are going through, and it's so confusing that we can't even begin to understand how confused relationships are for your generation.
Yeah. I think it's because we expect so much. We expect to have that 60, 70 year, you know, marriage and things of that sort. And so there's so much placed on it. So I was writing a portion in my book, and it says, sometimes, and I think this is what angered me so much, I do miss the role that their father was supposed to play in their lives, the strong, powerful, God-fearing provider. The importance of a father-daughter relationship in today's society it its own name, you know, the daddy issues. And it's not something that I want my daughters to suffer from. And so the older they get, I'm put in a position where as much as I'm trying to play father, that's not a role that I was designed to do. And there's a lot of things that have been coming up. I so value life. I've been seeing all of these different things that not only are babies being taken away in abortion, there's been, over the last few months, I've been posting a lot of different things about the deaths of babies across America, and some of them are at the hands of their father. And I think that was one of the ones that hit me as well. 10-month-old baby, and I'm not going to get into the details of the story, but he did things to her he was not supposed to and then beat her lifeless. 10-month-old. And I think that one hit me really hard. And then so after that, you know how algorithms work. Now more stories are coming up. And it was just hitting me. It was just hitting me all because I'm doing this part in my book. And then I saw that story and I just kept going and going. And a lot of it is, it was really difficult. So I think that's what a lot of that has been. And then watching the girls, you know, they a lot of times ask me a lot of different things, and sometimes it's things that I don't think about, or, you know, they're watching superhero movies and all of this stuff. And normally that's something that you have with your dad, but I'm a Marvel dork, so it's, I'm okay with that. But
you look like a Marvel dork.
I am.
You look like the type of girl that dates like the Marvel dork. You're like, how is that dork dating that beautiful girl? Oh, she's a Marvel dork too. Do you see those girls? You know what I'm talking about? I think my wife looks like the type of woman that should have married like a Marvel dork.
Yeah, that's me all day. I don't know what it is. I'm a Marvel dork.
See, I don't even can't stand those movies. I'll watch them with my family, and then a month later I'll say, hey, did we see this movie? They're like, yeah, you sat right next to us and watched it. I was like, oh, I was probably thinking about work the whole time. I don't even remember.
Well, the funny thing is that's how I am with DC. So I had the girls watch all the Marvel movies consecutively, and then they were like, well, what's next? DC? And I'm like,
You have to watch Jojo Rabbit with the girls.
Okay.
Yeah, you've got to watch Jojo Rabbit. It's awesome. I watched it with my kids. They loved it. I thought this is going to be too deep for them, and they absolutely, even Andrew loved it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyways, I plug Taika Waititi movies every chance I get. So it's just that. So it was just nothing profound. It was just like you notice the girls aren't, because I noticed there are times where one of my kids will really need their dad. You just feel it.
Yeah.
And then they don't pay attention to me for 6 months, and then all of a sudden they're clingy. And the kids go, they have their rhythms, right, where they need mom or they need dad.
Yeah. And I think just how much, I mean, I was a daddy's girl. So just how much I love my dad and respect my dad. And, you know, I randomly send I love you texts to him. And that's not something most people do in their 30s. But it is something that I do, you know. And I still call my dad daddy. Like when I'm texting him, daddy, blah, 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 you know. So it's just one of those things that sometimes when I'm doing it, I'm like, damn, man, my kids don't have this. My kids don't have this. And it was frustrating. So, yeah, I've been going kind of through that.
And it do they know they don't have it? Do they ever ask, or do they have a sense of longing, or is it just normal's normal for kids? What's normal?
Okay, so we're going to take it back to preschool real quick. Preschool, they had gone to preschool, and one of their assignments was to go home and get pictures of their family, because this is the first time they were really away from me on a daily basis. And so they were creating a family tree with pictures, actual pictures. And so they said, make sure you get a picture of grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, brothers and sisters, and yourself, so we can put it into the family tree. So that way, when you miss them, you can go over to the family tree and see them. So they come home, and they said, I think there were four at the time. And I had to read the assignment, do it for them, essentially. And I said, okay, we got granny and papa, we got mommy. Lily looked at me and said, what's a daddy?
Wow.
At 4 years old. And so that started all of, that was actually when it started for myself, that they're going to miss out on what I had. And when she asked, what is a daddy? I literally had to say, okay, granny and papa are my mommy and daddy, because we had never said daddy or brought it up to her. And I just figured at some point in time they would ask about it. So I thought, I didn't think. So fast forward to nowadays in elementary school, they have Daddy Daughter Day or Donuts with Dad, and they have, you know, Daddy Daughter Dances, and that's when they'll bring it up, you know. But for the most part, it went a really long time. And I also think that if they did ask about anything, you know, what does he look like, where is he from, where is he at, that kind of stuff, I would just be honest and answer it. Obviously, I'm not going to be spiteful and say anything negative. I've only spoke positive words about him in front of them. I think probably but they call him by his first name, because if they bring him up, and I'll say Marcus, because that's how I talk about him. But if they were to walk past him on the street, they wouldn't know who he is. Like, and they don't, it's not dad or father or anything.
Well, I'm going to pray for him, because it's never too late for him to attempt to aspire to make up for you abandoning you, And never too late for him to try to live up to his responsibilities to his children. And,
absolutely.
And you know, really, I feel that men who abandon their children, it's the dumbest thing in the, it's like, it's dumber than having a winning lottery ticket for $500 million and lighting it on fire. Right?
Like, yeah.
You wouldn't trade your kid for all the money in the world, right? So it's like lighting all the money in the world on fire. It gets, who would do that? No one would say, hey, look, a lottery ticket for $500 million. Let me light it on fire. No, no one would do that because it's stupid. But you know, that might not be, it might be smart to do that because God forbid that kind of money causes problems. But there's nothing more beautiful in life than being a parent. And like you said, the challenge is real. It's hard, but it's a good beauty. Act two in life is hard.
Yeah.
You know, his life is hard. Marcus's life is hard, right? Act two for him has been really hard, harder than yours. Think about that. He did the easy thing, and it wasn't so easy, was it? So in life, act two is hard. But is it beautiful? Is it noble? Is it, you know, and what you're living right now is it struggle. And and it seems like forever hard, but it's not forever. And you know, there's new troubles await for us, new challenges await for us. You know, I'm working on a new movie, and I was just talking to my writing partner, Darius. Have you ever met Darius?
No.
When you were in Chicago?
Nope.
We've been friends since we were five.
So this is the Sounds of Blackness, is that?
No, that's Michael.
Oh, okay.
Mike Smith. Have you met Mike?
Kind of through Facebook. I think it was.
He's wild. No, they're totally different personalities. Like, Mike is insane in a good way, just crazy, flamboyant, full of life, wild. He's a performer. Darius is the coolest cat ever. In fact, that's part of the problem. Our new documentary is him and I traveling the world. It's a buddy movie. And we need conflict. So we have to, like, look at what do we not like about each other. Like, we have to find out what we don't like about each other and introduce it into the story, because stories are driven by conflict. Life is conflict. The hero's journey is conflict. It's boring if there's no conflict. So, you know, all the struggles that you have right now are just, it's part of life. I know that, you know, I'm a little worried now because I'm finally getting my act together, and I just know that I have colon cancer. Like, that's got to be what's going on here. It can't be this easy. This is what's happening. No. I'm gonna go to the doctor and be like, "Yeah, well, my dad had it at my age."
It becomes rewarding. It becomes rewarding. I think that's a big thing. You get to that point where, you know, when in the Bible, when they're traveling, and it takes 11 days to get to the promised land, but it took them 40 years.
40 years.
Sometimes we're stuck in that 40 years, and we just don't see, you know. But it's rewarding once you get there. Once you have that faith. Once you are actually working to it. And I, a lot of times I think about that. So I could be act two is my 40 years, you know,
and it's going to be beautiful. Your act two is going to be beautiful. And I am just privileged that I get to be a little, I get to be a little player in your act two. I get to be one of the, you know, every hero on their journey needs friends. And you meet those friends in act two, and I'm privileged that I get to be your friend on your hero's journey. And it's you, I think you have to punch back in. I don't want to get you fired.
I do. I got to punch back in. But all right. Thank you. I thank you for everything, your love, your support, everything continuous, the friendship. You're one of my best friends. I could tell you anything. And I love everything that you do, and I support you no matter what. So I love it.
Well, I love you. I love Belly. I love Millie. And thank you for being on my anniversary show for Bella.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye, Chrissy.
All right. Bye.
Aloha. You can jump off. I'm going to finish. Okay. She jumped off. All right, guys. With that note where she was, you know, we're talking about how act two can seem forever. William F. Buckley, I don't know if he was the first to say it, but it's the first place I read it. He was asked if he likes writing books. And he said, Charlie Rose said, you know, you've written all these books. You must love writing books. And William F. Buckley says, I hate writing books. I love having written a book. And I feel that way about most of the movies I've worked on. I'm getting to enjoy it more because I'm being more tempered in my expectations. But I could say that I did not enjoy the process of Bella. And it was a very intense, it was beautiful, I'll say this. And it seemed like it was taking forever, you know, for us to get distribution. Even after winning the Toronto International Film Festival, it was another 12 months before we found our way into theaters. And those 12 months seemed like forever. And it just felt like if we made one mistake, like if we didn't win Toronto, I felt like the movie would never get distribution. And so I went to Toronto for weeks to build up a marketing push, a grassroots marketing push. And, you know, by the grace of God, we won the most prestigious audience award in the world. And at the time, it was like, if we don't win this, and there was a hiccup, a journalist had kind of started hanging out with our group. We didn't know it was a journalist, and she was just coming along with us. And we went to Mass, and we prayed at Mass for our film to win Toronto and go on to influence the world and be instrumental in ending abortion. And here was this journalist that hung out with us the whole time. We just thought she was somebody's friend. And if that story would have come out there, we would have never have won Toronto. And we just asked her, please don't, you know, we've trusted you. And we didn't know that you were a journalist kind of tagging along to write a story about us. And she spiked, she didn't write the story. We had a malicious, I'm not even going to say, but you know, it was very challenging. At Toronto, it was very challenging to find distribution. It was very challenging marketing a film before social media was really a thing. Raising money for the prints and advertising by the grace of God, that came easy, shockingly. It was the first time I tried to raise money for a film, and it came easy. It was beginner's luck. But then to raise money to buy out theaters, and we bought out hundreds of thousands of dollars in tickets that were given out to people, you know, homeschooled families, underprivileged kids. In Westchester County, we had whole schools busing kids thanks to Goya Foods. And Goya supported the film because they were like, A, as we know now, one of the brothers is very pro-life, and maybe they all are, but they were so excited to see a positive portrayal of Latinos centered around a meal. And they, after seeing the film, they were so inspired, they wanted to invite all of New York City. And they said, on one condition, you have to make sure with every ticket we buy, there's someone in the seats. So for weeks and weeks, I was on the streets of New York with Manny Perez, this big actor, and Eduardo, and doing partnerships with radio stations. And at the time, it seemed so long. It seemed like this film would never get distributed. And then in between distribution, theatrical, and DVD, I was so anxious for DVD. You know, we came out October 26th, and we came out on DVD, I think, in May. And it just, I couldn't wait for DVDs. But then the distributor was charging me 10 bucks a DVD. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that was so expensive. And we finally worked them down. But we were able to eventually give countless thousands of DVDs to pregnancy centers. And those DVDs ended up in the hands of young women who were contemplating making a decision. And so for me, I am friends with so many Bella moms, Bella babies, Bella men. I'm going to end on one other story. This is one Bella story. I don't tell a lot. And then we'll wrap up the show. So we were in New York, thanks to Goya Foods, and we were buying out showtime after showtime. But we were getting so much publicity, it was kind of hard to even find spaces to buy tickets. And so I had to get creative, like buying early morning shows. I'll never forget, I bought the early morning shows of Bella, and American Gangster came out at the same time. And all these old mob bosses and their wives rolled up for the first showing of American Gangster, and I watched them all come out, and that was very interesting. They were seeing a movie about someone they knew, someone they were friends with probably. That was very interesting. But I'd buy out the morning shows and the late, late shows. So there was this really big guy, kind of a wild guy. And he goes, what are you doing, man? I see you out here all the time handing out tickets. I'll help you. They're free tickets for the movie Bella. And this was like a later evening show. Like maybe, it couldn't have been that late. I think it was probably like 8 o'clock showtime. So we're handing them out. But he was kind of scary. Like, he'd yell at people, you need these free tickets. You need to come see this movie. And I'm like, this is not going to work. But it worked. He basically got them to take the tickets and do what he's told them. And they walked in the theaters. So I said, hey, brother, I want you to go see the movie. He's like, oh, man, I can't. I got curfew. I said, well, come back tomorrow. He's like, I got to be at the shelter by 10 or they lock us out for the night. I said, well, come back tomorrow. I'll be here and I'll give you tickets for an earlier showtime. He goes, all right, I'll be here. And so the next morning he came and he came out and he saw Bella and he was crying and he just said, mister, you don't know what kind of horrible life I've lived. And it was the first time that anyone had shared with me that Jose going to prison resonated with them, Eduardo's character. And he said, man, I've been in prison like that guy. And this movie told me I could be a good man. I could do something good with my life. It's given me a lot of hope. So he said, I want, can I invite my friends? I said, I will. I said, yeah, how many friends you got? He's like, I got a couple hundred. I want to invite all the guys from the shelter. And I thought, man, this theater is going to boot us because this is the 42nd Street Theater. They're going to boot us if I just bring in an entire group of guys for the shelter. And plus, it was hard to get big blocks because the shows were more or less selling out on their own. And I would wait till they sold out, and then I would buy tickets, or we'd work with radio stations with blocks of tickets. And so what was left was a lot for these guys. So I said, man, you know, the only time I could guarantee I can buy out a whole showtime for you guys in a way, and I had to be honest with them, in a way that's not going to make the management mad, is at 10 o'clock or later. So he's like, nah, I can't because, you know, we're going to miss the shelter. I'm like, yeah, I know, bro. Maybe we can do a morning during the weekend or something. You let me know. So he comes, but then here he comes with like 80 dudes and it's midnight. And there I am with Manny Perez, you know, the big actor, Manny Perez. And we're handing tickets out, talking to people on the streets. And he says, I told him about the movie and they all said, we don't need to go to the shelter tonight. We can sleep out on the street. We want to see your movie. So I gave them all tickets, and then I said, hey, bro, come here. Do me a favor. I want to buy everyone candy. I want to buy everyone popcorn. I want to buy everyone drinks and hot dogs. I'm going to give them the event of their life. And I said, can I give you some cash? Can you go in and buy it? And he looked at me, and he goes, mister, you can't give me $10. Don't give me $10. If you give me $10, I cannot help but go use it for drugs. So you're going to have to buy us the popcorn and soda. Don't give any of us cash. Just don't. So I said, okay. So I went in and I bought them all. But I loved his honesty and his respect. You know, he knew he wanted drugs. He knew if I'd have handed it to him, but he had the courage, you know, and honesty to look me in the eye and say, brother, don't give me any cash. And don't give us cash. Just go buy us food. And so that was a beautiful experience. So for me, guys, Bella was the beginning of a big change in my work. To promote a culture of life. It opened doors in politics. It helped us build relationships with elected officials. It opened doors in the entertainment business and in the news media. You'd be surprised at how many people. Rosie O'Donnell went on The View and said Bella was her favorite movie. And this podcast is really just an extension of what we were trying to do with Bella. We said that, you know, what was the goal of Bella when we'd be as a team? Alejandro Monteverdi, Eduardo Verástegui, Leo Severino, Sean Wolfington, and the rest of our crew, we would always say we want people to love more, judge less. We want to reveal the beauty of the human person. And film was the way to do it then. And film is still a useful tool, but, you know, maybe not the most influential tool. But we just need to be constantly looking at how people want to hear stories, how they want to talk, how they want to communicate with each other. And I think podcasts are the best thing going now because it's the anti-Twitter. On Twitter, all you have enough time to do is say, this is what I think, and by the way, you're stupid. And then people can reply, yeah, well, I think this, and by the way, you're ugly. And that's it. That's Twitter. And what I love about podcasting, I call it the anti-Twitter. It's an opportunity for you to hear what other people think in its fullness. And it's a great medium. I think people like Joe Rogan and Dave Rubin have been masters at teaching the art of empathy and thoughtfulness. And that's just the goal of this podcast. And it's really to share stories that maybe you won't hear other places. Like when we have Prime Minister Salih Hudayan on talking regularly about the Uyghur. But anyways, thank you for being on this first anniversary episode. I don't think we did an anniversary episode of Bella. And doing this show and doing this show and talking to Chrissy, I realize there's so many other folks that I want to have on and tell their Bella Hero stories, like my buddy Patrick, who is one of the greatest barbers in L.A. With a beautiful family. Maybe I'll have him on soon. But yeah, we'll just wrap it up there. This episode has been brought to you by Movie to Movement, promoting a culture of life, love, and beauty through the power of film. Go to movietomovement.com to watch Divided Hearts of America starring Benjamin Watson. The code is MTH for 20% off. Or you can go to salemnow.com where it's streaming directly and watch it there. Also by the Vulnerable People Project, a program of Movie to Movement, advancing the interests of the most vulnerable people in the world. From the Chaldeans in Iraq to the Uyghurs in Chinese-occupied East Turkestan to the child in the womb in your community. Go to thegreatcampaign.org and find out how you can stand shoulder to shoulder with the vulnerable too. Until next time, it's the Jason Jones Show. Aloha.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.